Welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppence.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And last week we promised you an update on Anne Boleyn, going beyond where we had left this beautiful 16th century queen. Kathleen, where are we in the Anne Boleyn saga and where are we going?
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to everyone who wrote to us and commented on the Anne Boleyn show. Not surprisingly, she has a lot of fans out there. There are a lot of people who really care about this subject. I mean, she really is a superstar for the ages. And the show that we did last week, even though we called it the Anne Boleyn show, was really didn't feature Anne so much as it featured her times and some of the things that were going on in her times that actually affected the history. And they were elements that we don't hear about in traditional Tudor scholarship. For example, last week we talked about the importance of understanding the role of the Medici and what was happening in Italy in terms of really getting a grasp of what was happening overall in Europe and then certainly in the world of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn. This is an element of Anne's history and of European history in general that really isn't looked at. I have never in any English history book or any Tudor history book seen any kind of analysis, even the most perfunctory analysis of the importance of the Medici popes and what their agenda is. And let's be honest, the church is still controlling the majority of the Western world in this period of time. So to completely ignore the position of the ruling family in the Vatican, which is the Medici, because there are two Medici popes during Henry's time, both of whom have a tremendous influence on what happens in his life and in the history of England. To ignore that is to have this enormous black hole in history. And sadly, that is exactly what has happened. So we talked a lot about that last week, but we didn't talk about Anne specifically. So this week, I want to talk a little bit more or a lot more about Anne herself, kind of starting from the beginning. And also, I want to look at first at how incredibly difficult it is to get your hands around truth when it comes to Anne Boleyn. Last week, we talked a little bit about this idea that the most prolific authors of the time were people who were Anne's enemies. And as a result, the majority of the material that we can reference is negative, was created as propaganda to disparage Anne, to damage her reputation. And that's one of our first hurdles in understanding who Anne really is wading through what is a legitimate source, what is a reputable source. Sure, we can document something, we can authenticate the dates, but we can't authenticate the intention behind the writer, can we? I mean, we don't know what was going on in the heads of a lot of these people as they were committing this information to writing, with the exception of Eustace Chapuis, who is the most prolific author of Anne Boleyn material, who was paid a fortune to disparage Anne and who called her only the concubine and the whore. So with all of those things said, go ahead.
He should be called the patron saint of tabloid journalism, shouldn't he?
He really started tabloid journalism, actually. That's funny, but it's also true. I mean, in a lot of ways, this is what was happening. There was so much gossip going on. Anne was so interesting. And this, you know, speaking from the point of view of a woman who writes about powerful women in history and how women who are powerful and who do make a difference tend to be either remembered as bitches or whores or worse, or completely eradicated from the record at all, you know, this is something that we have to look at. Anne was interesting. She was powerful. She had a point of view. And as a result, she was someone who was gossiped about an awful lot. And the majority of what exists in terms of contemporaneous accounts of Anne's life is no different than reading the National Enquirer or the Daily Mail, or worse, you know, those crazy tabloids that say things like, I had, you know, Elvis's UFO baby. It's that kind of material.
And I think in, like, you know, if we compare it within a British context, probably the modern equivalent would be something like Princess Diana, whereby the real Princess Diana is probably forever lost behind the hundreds, if not the millions, of fake stories that revolved around her.
Well, I think that's a great comparison. The difference is take that that idea of, you know, all of this information that obscures the real person, and then separate it by 500 years, separate it by all of this time that exists between Anne's life and now, and all of this time to destroy the records, to alter the records, to interpret the records differently, to ignore the records, which is much of what happens. And that's, you know, the case that we're going to make here, not just on these shows, but also in our books and on our website, AnneBoleyn.com. The case we're going to make is that nobody really knows the real Anne Boleyn. There is no accurate account of her life anywhere in the world, and that is because her early life is completely ignored. And until we understand Anne's childhood, and until we examine it, we will never know who she really was. And unfortunately, most Tudor historians, in fact, most British authors in general, including the novelists, not only ignore Anne's life, but they understand that if they pay any attention to Anne's life, it's going to change the story, and therefore they ignore her childhood completely. Because it's far more convenient to say, oh, well, we don't really know that much about it. There really aren't any records about it. And as a result, we don't have to deal with the inconvenience of historical fact getting in our way of a story that we have invented.
Just before the show, I was watching the episode of The Six Wives of Henry VIII, a production David Starkey has done, and the show on Anne Boleyn. And basically her youth is condensed in 2 or 3 minutes, whereby he goes to Hever, says this is where she grew up. Then her father made a deal with Margaret of Austria. She was sent there to learn French. We have a letter here in which Anne Boleyn writes back to her beloved father in French, saying, look, I'm learning French. This letter is sent from Belgium, where she is spending part of the summer in just outside of Brussels, where Margaret of Austria had a summer home. As soon as she, or implied rather by Starkey, is that as soon as she knows French, she is being sent back to Britain, and there she is placed roughly at the court, where she stands out as more French than anything British, and is quite often referred to for her French style. And that seems to be it. That seems to be all we need to ever know about Anne Boleyn's youth.
And that's all you need to know about Anne Boleyn's youth if you want to accept all of the existing portraits of her, which are shallow and cheap and completely untrue. If you want to understand who this woman really was, this incredibly powerful force who changed the world and did so intentionally, Anne Boleyn was not an accident of history. This is one of the things that infuriates me about the traditional Tudor scholarship, is this idea that she somehow was an accident of history, that, you know, it was strictly her scheming, her ambition to be something bigger than she was, that she was the pawn of her powerful male relatives. Anne Boleyn was nobody's pawn. She was an incredibly brilliant, educated woman with a very specific agenda to change the world. And that is the case that we're going to make. But in order to make that case, you have to understand the women who raised her and mentored her. And one of the things I want to say here, for those of you who are new to the Anne Boleyn story, who maybe have seen the Tudors or are fascinated by the whole concept of, you know, what was happening in her history or the Six Wives of Henry VIII, the information around Anne is so complicated because nobody agrees on anything and all of it is conflicting. So as an example, I want to say this. Just trying to analyze Anne Boleyn's place of birth and date of birth, and I'm not talking about nailing down the day, I'm talking about the year, is a full-time job. I have spent months going through so many volumes and so much different material, as has Philip, in multiple languages. This is the other thing. In our research, we're going beyond English. Because of Philip's fluency in Dutch and French, we're able to look into other records, which has been incredibly important. And we're going to have to enlist some Italians pretty soon to start doing some translating for us, too. Because in order to get to this story, we have to look all over the continent. But the fact is, the information that exists about Anne is so contradictory that there is not any agreement on even where she was born. Blickling claims her. Hever claims her. Was she born in one and raised in the other? We don't know. And how old she actually was when she sent to Europe. And this is critical, because was she 5 when she was sent to Europe, or was she 12 when she was sent to Europe? And the historians are split on this. I absolutely advocate for a 12-year-old Anne Boleyn going to Europe. And you actually mentioned Anne writing to her father in French to say, look at how well I'm doing with my French. And her French is pretty flawless very quickly. Well, this is not something that a 5 or 6-year-old can do, no matter what a prodigy she is. But it is something that a very, very smart 12-year-old can do. So that's just one of the many, many reasons that I advocate for Anne being born around 1500 or 1501 and also being 12 when she goes to meet the Grand Dame of Europe, her teacher, her mentor, the fantastic Margaret of Austria.
Yes, and again, I think she is one of the most remarkable women in history and one of the least known women in history, because this is a woman who, as such, wasn't queen. She married 3 times, and on 3 occasions her husband died at an unfortunate and young age. And she basically began to devote, at a young age, her life to educating the youngsters of her family and other, and at a later moment in time also other students like Anne Boleyn who came to live with her. And she became like an extremely posh boarding school. We are led to believe, for those who kind of like look at it, that this is just a boarding school for posh little girls to learn French and probably things like dancing and playing some other musical instruments. But what surprised me and what surprised you was that Margaret of Austria is one of the most unknown dimensions of the Turin Shroud. She is a woman who inherits it, who nurtures it, who stays with it, has a copy made as a drawing, and decides that the Turin Shroud should have a more permanent home rather than just traveling around with the family as it had been doing for a number of decades, if not a number of centuries, before it came into her possession. She is the one who has it and nurtures it just after the time, when it became out into the open in around 1450, and before in the late 16th century that it ends up being pretty much on permanent lodgings, though unfortunately not display, in Turin. So she has the Turin Shroud in her possession. She is clearly has some personal affinity with Mary Magdalene. All of these things suggest that what is going on in Mechlin, or Malines, if you want to use the French pronunciation of the town she lived in just outside of Brussels, something suggests that something far more interesting is happening than just a boarder school for young children.
Well, we absolutely know that. And again, this is an interesting aspect of how you have to look at history with really broad strokes if you ever want to learn anything. And remember, learning new material is the enemy of historians. Historians don't want a new perspective on history. They don't want you to discover something that's going to render everything that they have studied and written dissertations and books about no longer is valid. So people are not looking outside of the box here in academia. We are, and it was through investigating this completely unexpected aspect of the Shroud of Turin that we found this piece of Anne Boleyn's childhood that is so fascinating that even if we can't draw definitive conclusions, I think that it's so exciting to be able to look at this. And so here's the point. The Shroud of Turin in May of this year was on display, and we went to go see it. And in going to see it, we were doing intense research, trying to find out everything we could about the history of the Shroud of Turin and who had it and where it appeared and where it disappeared. And we were stunned to discover that Margaret of Austria was not only the guardian of it, but a very specific guardian. She is the person who creates the chest to protect it. There's a lot about what Margaret does with the shroud, which I won't go into because that's actually for a shroud show later on. But what becomes interesting is one of the things we discover is there's this history of women being the guardians of the shroud, very powerful women. Now, remember, Margaret of Austria is a princess. She's a Habsburg princess. She's a Duchess of Savoy through marriage, but she is the daughter of the Emperor Maximilian. And and Mary of Burgundy, who is an incredibly powerful force on her own. So at the time she is born, she is the most powerful woman in the world and never ceases to be. So I want to emphasize a couple of things. This woman, Margaret of Austria, is the most powerful woman on planet Earth throughout her lifetime. She runs Europe. She brokers some of the most important treaties in the history of Europe. This is a powerhouse woman. So she is brilliant, but she's also deeply spiritual. So this school that she begins running, which we have also found out, you know, more from investigating the other sources outside of the traditional sources, going into some of the Dutch biographies, for example, what we've discovered is that Margaret of Austria isn't just running a school for girls. This is not a finishing school. This is a very specific, almost Hogwarts-esque, and I say that jokingly, but, you know, what she's running is a very spiritual academy for very specific girls. And she is basing it on an ancient principle of educating sibyls, educating prophetesses. She only takes girls in amounts of nine girls or 18 girls. It's very specific how she does this. And this is a woman who, as we see in her life through her portraiture, has herself painted as a sibyl, has herself painted on multiple occasions as Mary Magdalene. So Margaret of Austria clearly sees herself in this defining role of a powerful spiritual feminine force, and she becomes Anne Boleyn's primary mentor from approximately the ages of 12 to 14. You cannot tell me that doesn't matter. You cannot tell me that the possibility that Anne Boleyn may have worshipped in the presence of the Shroud of Turin with the most powerful woman in the world, who was educating girls to step into their spiritual power. You cannot tell me that does not matter in understanding who Anne Boleyn was.
Absolutely, and to just kind of like enlarge on that, if there's people still doubting this, it's when you see or when you know that the first person to witness the resurrection is Mary Magdalene. That person is also the first, and it's actually in the Bible, the first person to see the shroud. There's no mystery there. It's plainly identifies it in the Bible, saying that she believes as soon as she sees the manner in which the shroud is lying there. Now, going back to her own tomb in Bourg-en-Bresse in France, Margaret of Austria's tomb is sort of like a double tomb, if that makes sense, whereby she is somewhat suspended in midair, and underneath is a depiction of Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, it's her depicted as Mary Magdalene. You know, we were in Bourg-en-Bresse in May, and we went to see specifically this extraordinary monastery that was created by Margaret of Austria, and her tomb is an extraordinary thing to see, and we will get pictures of it online because we took some fantastic pictures. And in this tomb, she has, on her own tomb, she had herself carved as a life-size sculpture of Mary Magdalene. So she clearly believed herself to be stepping into a Magdalene-esque role. There is no denying that. This is how she chose to be remembered in death, as Mary Magdalene. And so I think that that is an extraordinary thing that we have to look at. Also, this is a woman who was one of the great patronesses of arts and education. She creates this reformist court. So not only is Anne in the middle of this extraordinary, powerful spiritual environment, she is living in a court in Mechelen where, you know, people like Erasmus are having dinner with her. She is surrounded by these humanist and reformist minds. This is part of her education. Now, in addition to this, Margaret of Austria was renowned for having arguably the most extraordinary library in the world at that time, which consisted of all kinds of historical and spiritual documents. Now, within her library, one of the things she was famous for having and discussed openly were the works of an extraordinary author named Christine de Pizan. And Christine de Pizan, and that's P-I-Z-A-N, she is worthy of many, many shows on all by herself, but she was essentially the first feminist author. She was, you know, considered a heretic by a lot of people. Her work was very powerful and very dangerous, but also very extraordinary. So the fact that Margaret had these in her library and was arguably using this to teach girls like Anne Boleyn, again, is something we cannot ignore.
No, absolutely. And it just underlines that, you know, there was so much concentration of knowledge. And this wasn't just knowledge which Anne stumbled in. It's also clear that when you start digging into the Boleyn family history, that her father, Thomas, was absolutely aware of the kind of den of esoterica he was sending his daughter into.
The other thing about this is that Margaret, she built this extraordinary monastery in Bourg-en-Bresse, basically in memory of her husband, Philibert, the Duke of Savoy, Philibert the Fair, who, by all accounts, she was completely, utterly in love with and devoted to. And she is buried beside him, and there is this, he has an incredibly beautiful tomb in the monastery as well, in the chapel. And one of the things I wanted to say about this is it becomes very clear in watching Margaret's devotion to Philibert and her writing about him that this is a woman who believed in this idea of soulmates, of committed through time and space. And, you know, she was called the Lady of Mourning throughout her life, not just because she lost all three of her husbands, but because she never stopped mourning this loss of her great love. And so the romantic in me wonders, did she instill this idea into Anne Boleyn, this idea of finding a great love and changing the world with that love? And I truly believe, and this is part of the case that I'm going to make certainly in fiction, if not in nonfiction, that Anne was madly in love with Henry and he her, and that their initial love story is part of what makes this story of these two people so incredibly tragic. And it makes Anne's story so incredibly poignant. If you think that she went into this relationship with Henry, this marriage, truly with all of her heart and all of her spirit, believing that this was her soulmate with whom she was going to change the world, it makes the tragedy of what happens to Anne Boleyn, I think, so much more powerful.
Absolutely, and there's quite some indications, even in Bourg-en-Bresse, like the entwined letters of her, also a motto which later on Anne Boleyn will use with Henry. There are certain things which suggest that for her, Philibert was the one who she would never recover from and necessarily didn't want to do. And I think there's also another parallel, and this is kind of tying it into another major influence on Anne's life, which is Queen Claude, in the sense that the role of Mary Magdalene as defined by pure history is just this woman, this sinner who is or is not Jesus' wife. But in the esoteric dimension, the non-written down portion of history, Mary Magdalene, specifically in France, is also a preacher, is also a woman who educates. And that aspect is also very much apparent within Margaret. And the devotion to Mary Magdalene amongst those who were very close to Anne Boleyn in her youth is definitely the fact that Anne Boleyn likely made a pilgrimage to St. Baume in the company of Queen Claude's husband and the family of the king and some of, you know, some people around them. Also,
you are skipping ahead, my dear. You are skipping ahead.
So let's continue what still needs to be said. But one of these things which I also want to say is that in Bourg-en-Bresse is another place where she will get the Turin Shroud on exhibition. So this entire esoteric dimension of Mary Magdalene and the Shroud is not just an aspect which you see within the lifetime of Margaret of Austria and only with her, but it also is visible in other aspects of Anne Boleyn and seems to have been something which, you know, was remembered by some many centuries later as being part of Anne Boleyn as well.
Well, we find the Mary Magdalene theme running through Anne Boleyn's life all the way through France. And actually, anyone who is familiar with the French traditions of Mary Magdalene will not be surprised by this. The reverence for Mary Magdalene was a very powerful thing, specifically for women in the noble families in Europe, most particularly in France, but also in Belgium and the Netherlands and Germany and parts of Italy as well. So we see this in all of the women who are influencing Anne Boleyn. And after she leaves Margaret of Austria, and by the way, Margaret of Austria does not want to let her go, has written what a fantastic student she is, what a delight she is to have, and is none too pleased, honestly, when Anne is taken out of Mechelen and sent down into the court of France. But there is a lot happening at the time in terms of politics that makes it necessary for Anne to join the French court. One of these things is that her sister, Mary, is also coming to the French court. Now, because we only have an hour, I'm not going to go into great detail about what's going on in French politics, because it can be very complicated, too much so for our purposes right now. But here is what is important to know. Louis XII, the King of France, has two daughters, Claude and Renee. When he passes, he does not have a male heir. His daughter, Claude, must marry and ultimately marries the man who will become Francis I, the King of France. But Claude outranks him, basically. she really is the princess royal. She is the one who's descended from the king, although certainly Francis I is descended from the Dukes of Angoulême and is himself from a very important family. Now, here's where this becomes important. Francis I has an extraordinary mother named Louise of Savoy. He is the youngest of her children. Her older child is Margaret, another Margaret. So we'll call her Marguerite to differentiate a little bit. She becomes known as Marguerite of Navarre because she later marries the King of Navarre. But at the time, she's Marguerite of Angoulême. So we have Marguerite, we have a new Marguerite, and we have her brother Francis, who now becomes the King of France, marries Queen Claude. Queen Claude, however, is never very healthy. She deals with health issues her entire life. She's very frail. By all accounts, she was very sweet. She was very smart, but she was not very powerful because she was not very healthy. So what happens is her court is run by her in-laws. Her mother-in-law, the great Louise of Savoy, and her sister-in-law, Marguerite, come into the court and run this court. And it is within this environment that Anne Boleyn finds herself once again in the being tutored by the most powerful and important women in the world.
And it's also this period which has been vastly abused and used in fiction. It's here that the role of a sister becomes more prominent. It's here where historians are able for the first time to have a real go at Anne Boleyn in trying to make her into something which she is only by association and by implication if she were to walk into her sister's footsteps specifically, because it's known that her sister Mary has an affair with Francis at some point and is basically asked to leave, but Anne Boleyn stays on. So it's clear that whatever was happening didn't affect Anne Boleyn as such, even though it definitely affected her sister. So already it's clear that you know, she was considered to be a sole entity, so to speak, and not just heaped together in there with her sister. It also shows that the accusations which have been made, namely that she too was a prostitute and or had an affair with Francis I, should be substantiated with far more evidence, if anybody wants to make such an allegation, than so far has been done. So she is at the French court. She stays there for a number of years. It's at this moment in time that she seems to really be in France and is likely present at Saint-Baume. It's also a fact that Francis I gets to see the Turin Shroud, which is put on specific exhibition for him at one point after a rather impressive victory in Italy. all of these things she is witnessing. So whatever has started in Mecklen with Margaret of Austria seems to continue pleasantly and smoothly and divinely almost in France.
Now, here we have an Anne Boleyn who is in the service of Queen Claude. And to further your point on people needing to prove that Anne had any kind of poor reputation in France, really is that the French records completely contradict that, don't they? Don't they? The French records actually emphasize how popular Anne was at court, and specifically with the royal family. Queen Claude was known for her piety, that she would not have put up with any kind of promiscuity, certainly not to someone who was one of her ladies-in-waiting and one of the closest people to her. There is some indication that Anne may have even been her translator in terms of English, so she might have been incredibly close to her. Queen Claude's younger sister, Queen Renee, later in her life actually makes a statement about how kindly she remembers Anne Boleyn. She was several years younger, but she remembers Anne being a very kind person and being someone who she very much looked up to as a child. And all of those things, I think, are incredibly important. None of these women, queens in their own right, would have allowed promiscuous or off-color behavior in their court, which is precisely why Anne's sister Mary is sent back to England and Anne is kept in that place. Now, one of the interesting women here who is completely eliminated from the record when you read Tudor history is Louise of Savoy. No one even mentions her, and if they do, it is in the quickest of references. And no one talks about her importance in the French court. Again, here we have a place where in order to understand what's happening in England, you have to really understand what's happening in France, and you have to understand this extraordinary woman. This period of time had so many pioneering badass women. It is extraordinary. I mean, these are educated. These are powerful. The women are running Europe in this part of the 16th century. Louise of Savoy is out with Margaret of Austria. They are working together. They create something called the Ladies' Peace. They are creating peace treaties when the men can't do it. Extraordinary. But here's what I wanted. I want to talk about Louise of Savoy for a minute as the regent of France. She is the mother of the King of France. She is the mother of King Francis. Therefore, she's the mother-in-law of Queen Claude, and she is also the mother of Marguerite. Now, she, as a mother, determines early on that her children are going to have a phenomenal Renaissance humanist education, and that is what she does. Incidentally, just like Margaret of Austria, Louise of Savoy has herself painted later on as a Sibyl, and funds an entire historical research project called the Magdalene Question. So again, we have the most powerful women in Europe who are obsessed with finding out the truth about Mary Magdalene, who are spending enormous amounts of money to investigate who Mary Magdalene was, exactly what she did in Europe, and what her legacy was, and are educating children around them in this powerful humanist and spiritual way. Again, this is the environment to which Anne finds herself transferred now as a teenager, 14, 15 years old.
Yes, and the Magdalene Question, which she instructs the best scholars of the time to look into, is when you read online or when you read into the books as to what it envelops, most people will focus on the fact that it was a study as to who the various Marys of the New Testament were, whether Mary of Bethany was Mary Magdalene, who was this Mary, who was that Mary. But there's also a very important aspect of this study devoted to the study of Saint Baume and whether or not the bones of Mary Magdalene were located there, and large sections of this investigation involved documenting the available material and the stories and what at that time is available as archaeological records and historical records as to how Saint Baume came about. So this is not just some theoretical debate. This has also very direct applications to esoteric Christianity and a hidden tradition running around Europe, specifically involving educating women in a certain way.
Now, from this emerges the woman who is, for my money, one of the most fascinating lost characters of history. And this is the daughter of Louise of Savoy and the sister of the King of France, the great Marguerite of Navarre. This woman is known to the French very, very well. The French celebrate her, and she is called the mother of the Renaissance. She was an extraordinary author. She was a best-selling author of her time and a very controversial one. She ruled Navarre through marriage, which was a very, very tricky political piece of property in between France and Spain. But she, Samuel Putnam referred to her as the first modern woman. I mean, this is an extraordinary character. Now, what becomes extremely important here is connecting this amazing woman who was known as a heretic because she was so outspoken in her beliefs about the Reformation, but not reform like we think of it in terms of the traditional Protestant sense. This woman is not a Lutheran. This woman is a heretic. This woman is advocating for a break from the church in a way that is entirely Gnostic. What Marguerite's writings are about is, well, they're about many things, and she wrote extraordinary material. That was mostly allegorical, and you have to learn to read between the lines. But it's fantastic and absolutely worthy of your time to dig in to the work that she published. She is most famous for this extraordinary epic poem that she created, which is The Soul of the Penitent Woman. And this becomes an important, a very important piece of material later on. Marguerite's writings are considered so controversial that if she were not the sister of the King of France, she would have been put to death for heresy. Her brother had to bail her out a number of times. And in fact, the monks at the Sorbonne said that she should be tied into a sack and thrown into the Seine to drown because of her heresy. And it is this woman who we are making a case through our research and through finding the French records, through finding a lot of documentation that the Tudor scholars are ignoring, that Anne Boleyn had an incredibly close connection to this woman, and that arguably Marguerite of Navarre was Anne Boleyn's most important teacher and most beloved mentor, because Anne actually at the end of her life says this herself, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. And I think one of the great frauds of history are actually being perpetuated by those scholars who try to remove Marguerite of Navarre from Anne Boleyn, because even though I think the available evidence doesn't really suggest or doesn't display the intricate detail of their relationship in all the detail which you would expect intricate detail to be, the evidence is there that this was a very strong bond which somehow had existed for an enormous number of years. Now, why I'm saying that this is one of the greatest frauds is this. Tudor scholars are wanting and take great notice of examining one tiny detail, which is that at a time when, and we talked about this last week as well, at a time when there is an initial meeting when Anne Boleyn has just become queen between the King of France and the King of England, the question is posed whether Marguerite of Navarre wants to join the party and also come and meet Anne Boleyn and King Henry VIII. And the Tudor scholars say that Marguerite of Navarre says no to this, and that she says no to this because she feels that somehow the morals or the demeanor of Anne Boleyn is not good, and therefore she does not want to meet this woman. Well, the scholars who claim this, if they use footnotes, they normally refer to a French source, Jourda, which is a massive two-volume book on Marguerite of Navarre. There's also a condensed version, but in the massive two-volume work, we find the reference. And I am flabbergasted to find that when you start reading this, Jourda says nothing of the kind. Jourda doesn't speculate as to why Marguerite does not do this meeting. But more specifically, elsewhere, Jourda is pointing out that there was something between Marguerite of Navarre and Anne Boleyn. And to him, it's indeed a bit of a mystery as to why on this specific occasion Marguerite of Navarre does not want to meet Anne Boleyn. But this quite innocent statement, and to some extent openness of Jourda is completely twisted by English Tudor scholars into something which it is not, and is then perpetuated by people who copy these people without actually going back to the original source Jourda. And I think once again we see how something which was an extremely powerful bond between two women is completely eradicated by historians, either because they don't read French well enough or because they purposefully try to do something, because she pops up once again with a tremendous vengeance at the very end of Anne Boleyn's life.
Well, it's also a question, too, of, you know, in America, we call it the game of telephone. I think in the UK, they call it Chinese whispers. But it's a game played by kids where you whisper something into a child's ear and then you whisper it to the next child, and the next child. And by the time it comes around the circle, it looks nothing like the original story. And that's essentially one of the things that happens here, because no one is going to original sources. And Tudor scholars play this game of telephone with each other. They quote each other in this neat little circle. And so someone believes, well, if Eric Ives says it, then it must be true. Or if David Starkey says it, then it must be true. So what's happening is, rather than going to Jourda themselves and digging through the original source material, they say, well, Eric Ives is a leading Anne Boleyn scholar, and this is what he says Jourda says, so this must be the case. And the fact is, it is not. So much of the existing material that comes out of British scholarship is not accurate when it pertains to the continent. And as you discovered, and I with you, you know, at first we got the same Jourda book that a lot of the British scholars are working out of, which is the small condensed version, which doesn't really have a lot of information. But then we went to a considerable amount of effort and expense to buy the original two-volume set in a book auction and spent a lot of money on it. But because we felt like we had to get to this source and see if all of these people who are quoting Jourda in the British sources were really accurate. And it did not surprise us, although it certainly disgusts me, that when you read Jourda, you find out that none of it is true, that what all of these British scholars are using to say that Anne Boleyn did not have a relationship with Marguerite is simply conjecture. At best, I mean, at absolute best, it's conjecture. It's poor scholarship. It's bad translation. And as you say, it's really, you know, potentially intentional, because if they have to acknowledge Marguerite as a critical person in Anne's lifetime, they have a problem. And here's what happens. They say, well, there's no documentation, there's no evidence that Anne Boleyn was in Marguerite of Angoulême or Marguerite of Navarre's court. There is no evidence that she was actually in service to Marguerite, but there is evidence that she was in service to Claude. Therefore, Marguerite did not have an influence on Anne. Now, is this laziness, or is this lack of understanding of French history at the time, or is it agenda-driven? Because the fact is, Queen Claude was not running the court of France. Her sister-in-law, Marguerite, and her mother-in-law, Louise of Savoy, were running France. And Anne is essentially serving them, even though she is officially in the service of the Queen of France. By the way, you wanted to say that you're officially in the service of the Queen of France because the Queen is the highest-ranking person. So officially, it's going to go on the record that Anne is serving the Queen of France, because that's what it should say, and that's the best reference for her, right? But in fact, the Queen of France is most of the time not really well enough to perform the real duties of running the court. And so her very powerful mother-in-law and sister-in-law are doing it. So it's not even a stretch to say that Anne Boleyn had to have been serving both Marguerite and Louise during her years in the French court.
Absolutely. And This becomes apparent that there is this tremendously powerful bond between these two women at the end of her life, when she says, the only thing I would like to do more than have a child, a male child for my husband Henry VIII, is to see you again. So it underlines the extreme importance Anne Boleyn placed on her friendship with Marguerite of Navarre, but also to some extent I think the fact that she was looking towards Marguerite of Navarre to help her out of a situation which Anne Boleyn realized was becoming extremely dangerous for her, the fact that she was unable to produce children at all all her pregnancies after Elizabeth ended prematurely, and that she clearly felt that her usage as and her usefulness to Henry VIII was quite delimited, because he was so anxious to get a male heir that this was something of a problem for her. And the fact that she turns to specifically Marguerite of Navarre, I think, underlines the fact that they not only had a very close bond, but also to some extent that she felt that she was the only one who could actually potentially save her.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I think it's an issue of Marguerite could save her, but also that Marguerite would understand. Marguerite, more than anyone, would understand what she was going through and how important it was. It was important to this mission that they all shared for absolute reform. Now, remember, this poem that Marguerite writes is so extraordinary, this epic piece of literature, The Mirror of the Penitent Woman's Soul. And this is, and just to kind of, you can find it online, by the way, if you Google it. It's online in English, and it's definitely so worth wading through. It's so beautiful. And there's a punchline here, as an educated 47-year-old woman who loves this material, this is a very difficult poem to get through. So when I tell you who translated it at the age of 11 from French into English, I think that you'll be surprised, but it's an extraordinary story. But Marguerite writes this poem, and it is told from the first person of a woman expressing her love for Jesus as her Father God, as her brother, and as her lover and husband. And this is this extraordinary piece of spiritual literature, again, about mysticism, about love, about the power of women having their own Gnostic connection to God. And this is so separate from Catholicism. And this, I believe, is the heresy / reform that Anne is indoctrinated into and is passionate about, that has been lost from the record. You watch these people who are doing hatchet jobs on Anne, like that villain, what's his name, Bernard, who wrote that horrific book called Fatal Attractions. Again, tabloid trash. You watch them, and what they try to do, and it's so, it's such a crime against history and against women to watch someone like G.W. Bernard write about Anne Boleyn and completely disregard her spirituality and say things like, oh, well, we know she wasn't a Lutheran for this reason, therefore she wasn't important in the Reformation. Well, that's a very tricky thing, isn't it? It's very sly to say, well, I can prove that she wasn't a Lutheran, therefore she's not important. Well, I don't think she was a Lutheran either. I think she was something very, very different, something far more, far more progressive, far more dangerous. And ultimately, there is something missing in the history here that is passed from Anne Boleyn to her daughter. And that is this idea of women in power. And what I want to get to here is ultimately the legacy that Anne Boleyn leaves to the world is this idea of the power of a woman in her spirituality, which is something she passes to her daughter Elizabeth. Because it is her daughter Elizabeth who at the age of 11 takes an original manuscript that Marguerite of Austria has given to Anne Boleyn and passed on to her daughter, the young Elizabeth. Elizabeth takes this epic, complex poem and translates it from French to English. In fact, the English translation that we have today of Marguerite of Navarre's epic poem, for the most part, comes from the young Elizabeth I. Now, that is a legacy of feminine intelligence and spirit and power.
Absolutely, and it also shows that even though Anne Boleyn wasn't around to raise her daughter, as much as possible, it seems that her daughter was raised in her spirit. And when Anne is at the end of her life is expressing this desire to meet or speak to, and via some means possible, Marguerite of Navarre, unfortunately that can't happen, because at that moment in time, Marguerite herself is trying to get out of an extremely tricky situation. You were saying about how the professors of the Sorbonne were trying to arrest her, trying to even get her killed. And the king, Francis I, constantly had to step in and try to protect his sister from such execution, because he couldn't actually, I think it was the publisher of the book, that he actually could not save from execution. He unfortunately was executed for his involvement in doing this, what was considered to be a religious atrocity. So because she was fighting for her own survival, it seems that she did not have any time and or effort or influence over trying to get Anne away from an extremely dangerous situation, which literally was going to cost her head. Now, just going slightly back in time to younger Anne, when we look at the official timeline of history, we basically see that Anne Boleyn is portrayed as this girl who went to Europe, on continental Europe, to learn French, and then is sent back to Britain and hangs out at the English court, where somehow she either entices or King Henry VIII falls in love with her. What we are never told in any of these biographies of her is that she hung around the most powerful women in Europe, hung around people who were ruling women at that moment in time, and were also, you know, ruling instead of the men on a number of occasions, either because the men were still too young, or the men were weak, or the men basically couldn't be bothered. Yet, when we then see how some of the historians portray Anne Boleyn, not to mention G.W. Bernard, we see how he depicts her as a weak woman, how somehow she doesn't have the guts to do anything, how she isn't a force in religious reform, how it's all Henry who does all of these things. And it's so at odds with what we know and experienced on the continent that really the question should be asked, didn't she learn anything, if, Mr. Bernard, you are right?
Well, Mr. Bernard is not right. Mr. Bernard is not right about most things, because Mr. Bernard has not done his research. Mr. Bernard relies solely on the tabloids and really does very little digging. Now, the other thing about Bernard that's important to remember is he has written books about Henry as the great leader of the Reformation. There's an enormous amount of misogyny in the Bernard work. From my personal opinion, when I look at Bernard's work, I see a man who is trying to eradicate women from the record and from having any importance in the record. So I think part of his agenda for writing about Anne Boleyn as weak and unimportant is because he's trying to bolster his own point of view, which is that Henry was this extraordinary force for reform. Whereas I do believe that Henry was a force for reform, he certainly did not do this alone. And the reason that he was a force for reform, from my point of view, is because he had a very powerful partner who pushed him into this. Now, there's a lot of other side stories going on here. I mean, we really could do these shows into the next millennium about this period of time, because we have side stories about Thomas More. We have side stories about Cranmer. We have, you know, all of these things that are going on. But we're going to try to stay focused on Anne. I want to back up a little bit as well and say that we have the Anne Boleyn, who is in the service of Queen Claude as a teenager, going into the south of France, going into Provence with Queen Claude, Queen Claude's sister-in-law and mother-in-law, Marguerite of Navarre and Louise of Savoy. And they're going on a pilgrimage to the sites that are important in the understanding of Mary Magdalene's legend in France. It is said in the record that these women climbed St. Baume to the grotto to see where Mary Magdalene lived, and to see where there is a monastery carved into the rock, and to spend time there. Now, you and I have done that walk in the 21st century. I've done it about 6 or 7 times. And let me tell you something. That is not an easy walk. That is not an easy walk in the 21st century, even though those paths have been cleared. And we are not doing it in corsets and velvet and all kinds of, you know, feminine undergarments and, you know, inappropriate shoes. You know, we're doing it in hiking boots with, you know, lots of bottles of water, and that kind of thing. And let me tell you something, it's difficult. So my point is this, for these women to have made a pilgrimage to these sites that are important to Mary Magdalene would have been an extremely difficult thing and would have required extraordinary devotion in order to do this. This is not something that was done lightly. So again, we go back to this idea that Anne Boleyn is in the presence of these women who are on this pilgrimage to understand the importance of Mary Magdalene. And to, you know, you made a very important point, and I'm so glad you did a few minutes ago, which is that remember, to the French, particularly these women who are raised in these traditions, this is a tradition that I write about in all of my books and have studied for 20 years, Mary Magdalene is not, you know, is not the repentant fallen woman of the Bible. Mary Magdalene is the force who came to France and established a church of her own outside of Roman rule that was about the true and pure teachings of Christianity, that was about a type of Gnosticism of self-knowing and knowing of the divine within yourself. So the fact that these women were on this pilgrimage, and again, extremely impressionable 15-year-old Anne is with these powerhouses of spirituality and reform and education on this pilgrimage to understand Mary Magdalene, is something we cannot ignore.
Absolutely, we cannot ignore it, because I think it's the crux of the matter. And unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. But I think when we decided last week that Anne Boleyn definitely was a spiritual revolutionary, I think this week we've shown that she's definitely not alone in this endeavor, that she had the help of some of the most powerful women in Europe, and that they all, not just in England, but in France, Austria, the Netherlands, Spain, everywhere, were trying to bring about massive reform, and that once again the image of Mary Magdalene was what inspired all of these women, if not these men, to accomplish this. So we've come to the end of The Spirit Revolution. If you want to hear this show again, or you are listening to the recording, then you will know that we archive everything either via iTunes, BBS Radio, or our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. Until next week, from Kathleen and I,
the truth against the world.